Imagine for a second that you are, well, stuck in a really desperate legal battle.
Boy.
Yeah, and the judge assigned to your case is notoriously corrupt. And to make matters even worse, he literally hates you.
That is a terrible scenario.
Right, but your only possible strategy, like your absolute only recourse, is to just annoy him day after day until he finally gives in out of pure exhaustion.
Just wearing him down.
Exactly. And the crazy thing is, for centuries, a staggering number of people have been taught that this exact exhausting scenario is how Jesus told us to talk to God.
Which is wild when you actually think about it.
It really is. So, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we have a fascinating stack of source material in front of us. We are looking at an in-depth exegetical analysis of a very famous yet incredibly misunderstood biblical text. It's called the Parable of the Persistent Widow.
Right, from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 18.
Yes, exactly.
And just to clarify for anyone who might be new to that term, exegesis is simply the critical explanation or interpretation of a text.
Breaking it down to what it really means.
Yeah, it's the academic process of drawing the intended meaning out of a document rather than, reading our own modern assumptions into it. And the analysis we are looking at today does exactly that. It completely dismantles the way this story is usually told.
Because the exhausting takeaway most people have absorbed from this parable is essentially this, like, transactional formula.
Right.
The popular reading suggests that if you just pray hard enough and long enough and loudly enough, God will eventually get so tired of listening to you that he will pave.
They'll just give you whatever you want.
It's the squeaky wheel gets the grease approach to the divine.
Which, according to the scholars who authored our source material, is a fundamentally flawed and frankly terrifying view of the
I
universe.
mean, yeah, terrifying is the right word.
Because if you follow that logic, it reduces prayer to nothing more than nagging. And worse, it reduces the divine to a grumpy, indifferent bureaucrat who just wants a little peace and quiet.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because our mission today is to show you, the listener, based on this emphasis, that this text is absolutely not a story about wearing God down.
Definitely not.
We are going to explore how the authors of this exegesis argue that this parable is actually a profound exploration of God's character. We're going to look at the gritty, often painful reality of waiting in a broken world.
Yeah, the waiting is the hardest part.
It really is.
Yeah.
And we are going to learn about a very specific, brilliant, ancient argumentative technique that just, well, it turns the entire annoyed God theory totally upside down.
What's fascinating here is that the exegetical research points out Jesus is doing something much, much deeper than handing out a five-step program for getting your way.
Right.
He is setting the stage to explore the real theological and psychological mechanics at play when human beings are forced to wait for justice.
But to understand those mechanics, we kind of have to start by looking closely at how people fall into the trap of the annoyed God in the first place. So let's look at the primary trap outlined in the source. The massive misunderstanding that almost everyone falls into is that they equate God with the unjust judge in the story.
Right, they see the judge and think, oh, that's God.
Just to make sure you have the narrative fresh in your mind, the text says Jesus tells a story about a judge in a certain town who neither fears God nor cares what people think.
Not a great guy.
Not at all. And there is a widow in that town who keeps coming to him, demanding justice against her adversary. For a long time, this corrupt judge ignores her.
Yeah, he just brushes her off.
But eventually he says to himself, you know, even though I don't fear God or care about men, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will see that she gets justice so that she won't eventually come and attack me.
And right there is where the psychological trap springs.
Oh, totally.
The human brain naturally likes to draw direct parallel lines when we hear a story. We read this and we immediately think, okay, the widow represents me praying. Therefore, the judge must represent God listening to my prayers. And since the judge only answers because he is intensely annoyed, God must only answer when I annoy him enough.
It seems like a logical leap at first glance, I guess. But our source material makes it crystal clear that this is a total misreading of the text's internal logic.
Completely.
The exegetical analysis argues that Jesus isn't comparing God to the judge at all.
Precisely. And this is where we have to look at the historical teaching methods of the time. The authors of our source highlight that for anyone reading this text through a first-century Jewish lens, Jesus is using a classic rabbinical teaching method.
Right, and that method has a specific name. I saw that term all over our
Yeah,
notes.
it's called Qual Wahomer.
Qual Wahomer. What exactly is the mechanism behind that? Like, how does it actually work in an argument?
Well, it literally translates from Hebrew to mean light and heavy.
Okay.
In classical logic, it basically means arguing from the lesser to the greater.
Got it.
It is a rhetorical way of establishing a point by saying, if something is true in a lesser, smaller, or vastly inferior circumstance.
Not the bad judge.
Right. How much more must it be true in a greater, more perfect circumstance?
Okay.
To use a modern example, think about a job. If a notoriously stingy, difficult boss gives you a day off because you really, really need it, how much more would a generous, deeply empathetic boss give you the time you need?
I see. So it isn't a comparison of equals. It's a contrast.
Exactly. The source material argues that Jesus is setting up a stark, deliberate contrast. The text is designed to show that God is the exact opposite of the unjust judge.
Wait, so if God isn't the judge, how does the Quayle-Homer argument actually connect the two? Like, what are the specific contrasts the text is drawing here?
The exegesis breaks it down into three distinct dynamic contrasts. First, look at their fundamental relationship to justice itself.
Okay.
The text explicitly states the judge doesn't care about justice or people.
Mm-hmm.
He operates out of a completely corrupted moral center.
Right. He's just selfish.
Exactly. But according to the theological framework of the text, God is the very author and definition of justice and righteousness.
That's a huge difference right off the bat.
It is. The second contrast involves their feelings toward the petitioner. The human judge is quite literally just annoyed by this widow.
He's a nuisance.
Yeah, an obstacle in his day. But the theological premise of the surrounding text is that God deeply loves and knows his children.
Right.
And then the third contrast is their underlying motivation for finally acting. The judge only gives in out of selfish preservation. He just wants to save his own skin and get this woman out of his hair before she ruins his reputation.
Or gives him a black eye, as the translation says.
Right, as the Greek text playfully exaggerates, God, on the other hand, answers out of deep covenantal love.
You know, reading through how the source lays out those motivations, it reminds me of the difference between, like, a selfish roommate and a loving parent.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Let's say you have a toddler crying for a snack. A selfish roommate who just wants the apartment to be quiet so they can watch TV might toss the kid a cracker.
Right, just to stop the noise.
Exactly. But a loving parent also gives the kid a cracker. The action looks exactly the same on the surface. Someone gets a snack.
Yeah.
But the underlying motivation is entirely different. The roommate gives the snack strictly to make the noise stop. The parent gives the snack because they actually care about the nourishment of the child.
That is a highly effective way to conceptualize the Quayle-Homer argument.
Thanks.
The roommate is the lesser flawed circumstance. The loving parent is the greater perfect circumstance. And that brings us to what the source material considers the real aha takeaway of this ancient logic. It is a hidden assurance buried right there in the text. The analysis concludes that the argument is basically saying, if even a corrupt, heartless human judge who doesn't care about you at all will eventually dispense justice just because of sheer persistence, how much more eagerly and righteously will a loving Father in heaven answer the people he has chosen?
How much more? I love that. That completely flips the script on how this text is usually taught.
It really does.
The authors are arguing that when you read this, you shouldn't feel like you are talking to a brick wall that you have to slowly chip away at. You are supposedly talking to a father who is already inclined to love you.
Yes. The exegesis argues that the Quayle-Homer structure guarantees God's goodness right from the very start of the parable.
But, you know, if we accept that premise, it creates a massive logical gap.
Oh, definitely.
If God is so much better than this unjust judge, if God is actually this loving father who is eager to dispense justice and help his children, then why is there a delay at all?
That is the question.
Right. If the parent wants to feed the child, why is the child still sitting there hungry? Why do we have to be persistent in the first place?
And that is the pivotal question of the entire text. That logical gap is exactly why the authors of this paper insist we look closely at the historical and eschatological context of this story.
Because the text isn't just ignoring the delay.
No, not at all. The delay represents the very real, very painful everyday experience of human life.
To understand that delay, our sources say we first have to really understand the petitioner herself.
Mm.
We have to look at the historical reality and the deep symbolism of the widow.
Yes. To grasp the weight of this, we have to transport ourselves back to the ancient Near East, into a deeply patriarchal, highly structured society.
Right, very different from today.
Very different. In that specific historical context, A widow was the ultimate symbol of marginalization, vulnerability, and total powerlessness.
Because the safety nets just weren't there.
Exactly. Yeah. The social safety nets we rely on today, like welfare, life insurance, legal aid, they simply did not exist.
And the legal system itself was basically stacked against her, right?
Entirely.
Yeah.
She had no husband to act as a male advocate for her in court. She likely had no inheritance rights of her own.
So no money.
Right, which means she had no money to bribe this corrupt judge. And historically speaking, a bribe was often how business was actually done in those courts.
Wow.
She had no political leverage, no family backing, and absolutely zero social standing. She was essentially a ghost in the machine of society.
You know, the source text highlights a detail that I found incredibly striking. Given all of those disadvantages, her only weapon was her voice.
That's it.
Just her voice crying out into a legal system that was fundamentally designed to ignore her existence.
And this is where the exegesis connects the historical reality to the theological meaning.
Okay.
Spiritually speaking, the authors argue that the widow represents the believer and the church as a whole, living in a fallen, broken world. According to the text, recognizing our own widowhood is the absolute prerequisite for genuine prayer.
Widowhood. What exactly does the source mean by our own widowhood?
Well, the analysis defines it as coming to terms with our own complete spiritual bankruptcy. It's the realization that in the grand scheme of the universe, we don't have the leverage to force God's hand. We don't have spiritual bribes we can offer.
We can't buy our way in.
Exactly. We are completely and utterly dependent on grace. The argument is that until we realize our only true weapon is our voice, our desperate reliance on God rather than our own strength, our prayers are just negotiations, not true faith.
Wow. That makes the requirement for persistence make a lot more sense.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. If you have no other leverage, you literally can't afford to stop speaking up. But what about the timing? Like, why is she forced to keep using that voice over and over again while God supposedly delays?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the exegetical analysis points us to a crucial structural clue in the text. We cannot separate Luke chapter 18 from what happens immediately before it in Luke chapter 17.
Right, because context is everything in literary analysis.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just before Jesus tells this parable of the persistent widow, the text shows him teaching his disciples about the end times.
Okay.
He was warning them that days of great suffering, profound injustice, and deep confusion were coming on the earth.
So setting a pretty dark stage.
Very dark. So when the narrative immediately transitions into the story of the widow and the delayed judge, the analysis argues that the delay of the judge actually represents something highly specific to the original audience.
Which is?
It represents the perceived delay of Christ's return and the final, ultimate restoration of the world.
So it's an eschatological delay.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Eschatology being the theology of the end times, of final things and ultimate justice.
Right.
Our sources point out that this parable is fundamentally intended as a survival guide for what theologians call the tension between the already and the not yet.
The already and the not yet. That is such a brilliant way to frame it. Let's break that concept down for anyone listening who isn't steeped in theological terminology.
Sure. The authors explain it like this. The already refers to the theological belief that Christ has already won the ultimate victory over sin and death through the resurrection.
The decisive battle has been fought and won.
Exactly. But the not yet refers to the reality that humanity does not fully experience the peace and justice of that victory yet.
Because we look around and the world is still deeply broken.
Very broken. There is still sickness, systemic injustice, corruption, and death. Believers are living in the excruciating tension between those two realities.
You know, it makes me think of the historical gap between D-Day and VE Day in World War II.
Oh, that's a great example.
Right. After D-Day, the decisive blow was struck. The Allies knew the war was essentially won. That was that already.
Right.
But the fighting, the casualties, and the massive suffering continued for nearly another year before the final surrender. That was the not yet.
That is a perfect historical parallel, really.
And the thing is, living in that eschatological waiting room between the already and the not yet takes a massive psychological toll. Human psychology is simply not designed to sit in a waiting room indefinitely, surrounded by pain. I mean, you know the doctor's eventually going to call your name. You know the cure is in the building, but you are just sitting there on a plastic chair while the clock ticks and your immediate suffering isn't going away.
Which is exactly why the text moves from theology to deep psychological application.
Right.
How does a belief in ultimate justice translate into what a person actually does on a random Tuesday afternoon when the injustice of the world feels overwhelmingly heavy.
Well, the exegetical analysis points out that the text doesn't hide the ball here at all. Luke 18, verse 1, explicitly states the entire purpose of the parable right out of the gate.
It lays it right out.
It says, "Then Jesus told his disciples a parable to show them that they should always pray and not give up."
Yeah.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Our deep dive sources suggest that within the framework of this text, persistent prayer is actually considered the highest form of obedience.
The highest form. The authors ask us to really consider the psychological reality of waiting. When you are stuck in that tension, the greatest threat to your obedience, the biggest danger to your worldview, isn't usually some massive dramatic rebellion.
Right. People rarely wake up one day and decide to become an evil villain.
Exactly. The greatest, most insidious threat is apathy.
Just slowly going numb to the world around you.
Yeah, exactly. When people pray for a real desperate breakthrough, maybe they are praying for a loved one to get sober, or for healing from a chronic illness, or for provision when they literally cannot pay their rent.
Real tangible pain.
Yes, and God appears completely silent.
Yeah.
Well, human nature naturally grows cynical. We start to ask ourselves the most dangerous, quiet question, why keep trying? Why keep obeying the rules if it doesn't change my painful circumstances?
Okay, I have to pause here because I want to offer some genuine pushback on the source material's premise.
Okay, let's hear it.
Especially on behalf of anyone listening who is currently sitting in that waiting room. The analysis claims that the Quelle Homer argument proves God is better than the unjust judge and that his delays are part of a larger redemptive timeline.
Right.
But if I am the person in pain, if the human judge eventually acted in the widow's actual lifetime to relieve her suffering, but God's redemptive timeline means I might literally die waiting in this broken world, how is he a better judge from my perspective? Doesn't that mean the Quelle Homer argument falls apart entirely?
That is an incredibly sharp pushback. And honestly, it gets to the absolute core of why this text is so challenging for modern readers.
It's a tough pill to swallow.
It is. The authors of the exegesis address this exact friction. They argue that our struggle with the delay stems from how modern culture wires us to view justice in relationships. We tend to view God transactionally.
Like a transaction, yeah.
And we define justice as immediate comfort or the immediate removal of our specific pain.
Right, the vending machine mindset. I put in my obedience, I press the button of prayer, and the blessing should immediately drop into the tray in this lifetime.
Exactly. But the source material argues that the eschatological perspective of the text redefines justice entirely.
How so?
The text is operating on the premise that ultimate justice, the complete eradication of sin, death, and suffering, cannot happen until the final restoration of the world.
The end times?
Right. So what feels to us like God ignoring our cries is, according to the text, God working out a cosmic redemption that extends far beyond our individual lifespans.
Wow. Okay.
The analysis claims that true obedience in this framework requires believers to surrender their demand for instant gratification and to trust that the Quelle Homer logic holds true on a scale they cannot yet fully see.
Okay, but if God's timeline is so massive and fixed and we aren't supposed to view prayer as a transactional vending machine, what are we actually doing when we persist in prayer? Like, why keep talking if the timeline is already set?
This raises an important question indeed. And the exegetical answer lies in the concept of alignment versus manipulation. Look at the widow's legal request again. She wasn't trying to change the law.
Right.
She wasn't asking the corrupt judge to invent some brand new standard of justice just for her specific case. She was asking the judge to enforce the existing law.
Okay, so she wasn't asking for a special favor. She was demanding that what was already right and true be realized in her life.
Precisely. And the authors draw a direct parallel to the purpose of prayer here. The source material suggests that persistent prayer is not a steering wheel where we try to turn God's direction or change his mind. It's more like a compass.
A compass. I like that. How so?
Think about how a compass works. The magnetic north is fixed. Right?
Yeah.
It doesn't move based on what you want. According to this theological framework, God's will is the magnetic north. Persistent prayer is the act of holding the compass flat, day after day, in the middle of the storm, watching the needles shake and spin wildly.
Because of our own desires and panic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because of our own desires, our own panic, and our own brokenness, we keep holding it there until our internal needle finally stops spinning and aligns with that fixed magnetic north.
That is a phenomenal way to explain the mechanism behind it. So persistent prayer isn't about wearing God down until he changes his mind to match ours.
No.
It's about continually throwing ourselves into the discipline of prayer until our hearts and desires align with his ultimate will.
Exactly right.
The daily struggle makes us our own worst adversary, and persistent prayer is the mechanism that trains us to desire what God desires, giving us the supernatural strength to survive the waiting room.
Exactly. The exegesis argues that the persistence isn't for God's benefit, it is for the believer's survival.
Which brings us to the haunting conclusion of this text. The authors of our source material point out that Jesus ends this entire parable with a chilling, open-ended question.
It's definitely not a neat, tidy wrap-up.
No. In Luke 18, verse 8, the text says, "However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?"
It is a rhetorical question that just hangs in the air, demanding the reader to self-reflect. And the analysis makes a brilliant point here. The text does not ask if the Son of Man will find perfect people when he returns.
Right, no.
It doesn't ask if he will find mega successful, wealthy churches or brilliant theologians who have perfectly mapped out the timeline of the end times or believers who never ever doubted while they sat in the waiting room.
The text just asks if he will find faith.
Yes.
But based on this exegetical deep dive, we have to recognize that the author of Luke is talking about a very specific, fiercely defined type of faith.
Yes, very specific.
The source argues that he is looking for that gritty, relentless, widow-like faith. The kind of faith that flat out refuses to stop crying out for justice, even when the eschatological waiting room is pitch black and the delay feels agonizing.
The researchers conclude that that is the true definition of faith within this parable.
That grit.
Yeah. Getting up as you fall day after day and crying out when you feel completely inadequate, totally spiritually bankrupt, and utterly marginalized. That is the endurance the text is calling for.
It isn't polished.
No, it isn't polished. It isn't a neat formula. It is a desperate, unrelenting reliance on the goodness of God in the face of blinding cynicism.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? If we zoom out and synthesize everything the exegetical analysis has shown you today, it basically comes down to this. On one hand, the ancient Quahlehomer argument guarantees God's intrinsic goodness and his profound love for humanity.
Right. The text positions him as the ultimate perfect father, not the annoyed, corrupt judge.
But on the other hand, the eschatological reality, the undeniable fact that we are currently living in the not yet of a broken world, demands our gritty, stubborn endurance.
The authors argue that the entire purpose of the text is to teach the reader how to hold both of those seemingly contradictory truths in tension.
Right.
God is perfectly good, and yet the wait for ultimate justice is profoundly hard.
And that tension brings us to a final thought for you to carry with you. A provocation that builds perfectly on the historical reality of the widow we discussed earlier.
It all goes back to her.
It does. Think back to her situation in the ancient Near East. Remember what the scholar said about her utter lack of leverage? She had no money, no political power, no social standing, no male advocate.
Nothing.
Her only weapon in a deeply corrupt, patriarchal world was her voice.
It was literally all she had left to fight with.
And if we apply that symbolism to our own lives, as the text intends, then giving into apathy, letting cynicism win, and going silent isn't just a quiet, personal loss of faith.
No, it's bigger than that.
It is the exact moment the unjust forces of this world actually win.
Wow.
By silencing your cries for justice, the brokenness claims victory. So the question this ancient text forces us to ask ourselves is this. Where in your own life have you let the delay silence your voice? Where have you sat in the waiting room so long, enduring so much pain, that you simply stopped crying out?
It's a heavy question.
It is. But maybe today is the day you refuse to let the apathy win. Maybe today is the day you pick up your only weapon and use your voice once again.